The Science Inside Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Science Inside. My name is Elna Schutz.
And I'm Lebogang Madisha.
So, Lebo, I don't know if you know this, because I don't think just any normal Joe on the street is aware of how many dinosaur fossils have been found in South Africa and how rich of a history we have.
Actually, that is so true, Elna, because like, recently, there have been all these dinosaur discoveries that have been happening, and they're just coming around. Like, I don't know, it's a trend that they've started, these paleontologists and archaeologists discovering dinosaurs.
And if you think about it, most of us know about the cradle of humankind. We know about, like, Mrs. Plett, Hermina Leddy. But it took me a while to realize that, of course, if there's a dinosaur fossil to be found, or, a species that's related to humans even, there's not going to be one of them.
Exactly.
Or 10 of them. There's actually going to be lots in the whole country.
Exactly.
Yeah, so South Africa, if you didn't know, we have a really rich history of paleontology, or rather of fossils, and that means we have some very dedicated, cool scientists working on this kind of stuff.
Indeed. And some of them are based right here at the Wits University. And Wits has been involved in a lot this week. I don't know if you remember that recently they were a part of discovering a new species of a giant dinosaur in the Free State province. And it was the largest land animal alive on Earth when it lived nearly 200 million years ago.
So usually these dinosaurs have these like really long, complicated, like Latin scientific names, right? So what did they call this one?
Surprisingly, it was a very nice name that they chose. I like the fact that it was a Sotho name as well, keeping it, you know, relevant to where we are.
Nice and local.
Exactly. It was called Ledumahadi Mahube, which means a giant thunderclap at dawn.
That's just a cool name, like, for anybody.
Exactly. And it makes me think of, like, a really big thing, because a thunderclap at dawn, like, every step is just shaking, I don't know, the skies, I guess, but the ground in this case, because it's a dinosaur on land.
Okay, but then it can't have been, like, a small nyana dinosaur if it has a name like that, right?
Definitely. They chose this name because this dinosaur has a very robust stature, which is similar to the sapiens, even though they've evolved separately. This one in particular has kind of a elephant posture to it.
Okay, but no trunk.
No trunk, no.
So that's just one example of, a recent discovery. We're not talking about like the 1980s here. We're talking the last few weeks and months. Constantly scientists are telling us new things about the creatures that lived long ago, not just somewhere on Earth, but our patch of Earth in South Africa right here. And so today we are digging into another exciting recent discovery in today's main story. We're talking about the first, or a very big, dinosaur grave or graveyard recently unearthed in the Eastern Cape.
But in Unscience today, we find out about how you get girls, particularly if you're a male bird.
I was just about to say, this is not a dating show.
No.
Is it the science of Tinder?
That would be pretty cool, though. The science of Tinder. People would get perfect matches all the time.
Maybe we should do a story on that in the future.
We should, actually.
So this time it's about birds, you were saying. That's our Unscience feature in the middle of the show. We take a few minutes out to look at just some ridiculous research. I'm guessing the birds aren't using Tinder, but we'll find out more later.
It would be nice if birds used Tinder. I mean, think about it. Except they'd be distracted and maybe they wouldn't be able to fly properly. They'd bump into each other. They're like, oh, I'm swiping left, swiping right. I don't like you. I like you.
His tail feathers. I just couldn't. So later in the show, after that, we find out, going back to the paleontology side of things, we find out how modern science relates to the stories and experiences of people living in South Africa long ago, and how, you know, scientists from Wits were definitely not the first people to find those dinosaur bones. And it's very interesting how the stories and the mythology of our area relates to dinosaurs. There's a little bit of monsters and creatures in that one. I'm looking forward to it. It's all on the show, but as always, we'll kick it off with some science news in a minute.
And don't forget, you can always find us on our social media on Facebook as VowFM, and you can also tweet us at VowFM using the hashtag #ScienceInside.
If you're a regular listener, you'll know that this is not the only place you can find us. Of course, we are on VowFM every Monday night, 6 to 7. But if that's not your jam, if you're maybe busy in this exact time, that's not a problem, because we have a podcast which you can find on iTunes as The Science Inside or vits.journalism.co.za/science.
And for all of you guys steady streaming with us right now, you can catch us on our WhatsApp line at 084-078-4912.
But before we get into dinosaurs, mythology, and monsters and birds, let's look at some news from the world of science.
This week's Science Headline.
So every single week, we share one story each with each other, just somewhere from the world, far away or close. And Lebo, I've seen a lot in the headlines about what you have for us today. It's really pretty amazing and big news.
Yes, this story in particular, actually, I have a little bit of a soft spot for this one, because it's a story of a loving mother literally just caring for their child. But it's a very unique story in that it's also taking a very risky approach and breaking the boundaries of science. So it's about the first HIV transplant in the world. Ooh. How amazing is that?
So an organ transplant.
Yes.
From somebody who's HIV positive
and alive.
Okay. Okay, yes. Tell us more.
So, firstly, the story is from Times Live and Begisisa Center of Health Journalism. Recently, reports on an HIV-positive mother donating her liver to her child have marked the first HIV transplant and uncovered a whole new pool of possible organ donors. The transplant was performed by doctors from Wits University in order to save an HIV-negative 13-month-old baby who was born with end-stage liver failure. That already is a very, very tough situation. This child is so young.
Sure. Wow.
And now the possible risk of the child actually contracting HIV actually still remains.
Of course. Mm. Yes. I mean, it's a really risky situation, obviously, like you said.
Exactly. And I'm sure the mother has been taking her medicine to prevent the child from contracting before birth. Now it's a thing of after birth, you could possibly contract this. But Dr. Jean Buerta, principal investigator and transplant surgeon and professor of surgery in the Department of Surgery in the School of Clinical Medicine in the Faculty of Health Science at Wits University, had this to say, that even if the child develops HIV afterwards, we've given the child an opportunity to live a normal life.
See, that's true. Because at least the child is alive. That's first and foremost. You know, this organ transplant has saved this child's life, and that's in one sense already so amazing.
Exactly.
And I'm sure the family and the doctors will deal with any other consequences afterwards. I'm sure the child's family is so happy. But how exactly did they figure out the baby's HIV status?
So the child has been pre-exposed to prophylactics to try and prevent the HIV virus from spreading, from getting to them.
Sure.
And this might have prevented them from contracting the virus, but this is only time's tale to tell. So we'll find out as the child grows whether they've actually contracted this virus. Weeks after the transplant was conducted, doctors did think that the child was HIV positive, according to Dr. Buerta. But the transplant team then was able to use a specialized testing HIV test by the National Institute of Communicable Diseases, or the NICD, and they could not find any active HIV infection in the bloodstream of the child. Now, this means that the child might have not been HIV positive. So it's either or right now. They're not actually sure.
Okay, because there's probably still a lot to happen in this process. Mm. But this case, as amazing as it is, we have said it's high risk. What does it show us, or what do we know now about the riskiness of these kind of cases, specifically around, you know, an HIV transplant?
Indeed, it is a risk. And I must mention that this kind of transplant is only granted under extreme circumstances. So as we understand, this very small baby needs to live. So what else can they do? Just give this child the liver that is available and matches them. Now, a donor's organ usually returns to its normal cell count a few months after the transplant. And keeping in mind that there've never actually been any living HIV-positive donors before. So this has only been observed in HIV-negative donors.
Right.
And organs from deceased donors who are HIV-positive are normally what are given to other HIV-positive recipients. So
makes sense.
We're crossing boundaries and we're crossing the life part of it as well.
Okay, right.
So from deceased to living, but now it's both living and crossing the virus and not infected by the virus boundaries.
Okay.
So now for the recipients in this case in particular, the child that is, even though there's no evidence of HIV in this child's blood, there's a possibility of the virus being dormant because the child has been on antiretrovirals, since the transplant began and after that. And this might have just suppressed the actual virus in the child. So that's why they haven't been able to detect it. Or it could have gotten rid of it completely.
Oh, so we don't know yet. It could still go either way. I guess one question that comes up for me is, this is such a big risk on all sides to take. Why exactly did this mom take this risk, or the whole team? I mean, there must have been other options.
Right. I mean, one can only imagine that. But this 13-month-year-old baby was actually on the waiting list for a liver transplant for 180 days.
Sure, okay.
And that's a long time for a young infant still developing.
Mm-hmm.
And with a defected liver, resulting in blood not flowing in and out of it, the liver is slowly reaching its point of shutdown, and this would lead to the baby losing their life.
Okay.
Exactly.
So very serious.
So this mother did what any parent would do, honestly, which is save their child's life by any means necessary. And I think it's safe to say that she is the real hero in the story, in that she saved her child's life and she just unlocked a whole new pool of donors, basically unlocking a whole breakthrough in the world of science.
And you know what? Even though obviously we are hoping that the baby remains to seem HIV negative, I think I'm sure that researchers will learn so much about this regardless of what happens next.
Definitely.
About this process, about how the virus works in, and even just organ transplants in general. So, either way, I think it's a surgery that's going to be phenomenal, and it's always great when these things happen at home.
Definitely. So, Alna, what do you have for us today?
Something slightly less heavy, but very useful for some people from the world of tech. Lebo, be honest with me. How many hours a day do you think you spend looking at screens?
Too much.
Too much hours.
Yes, just too many hours, too much hours.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Because if I think about it, at work, I'm looking at screens probably 7 to 8 hours a day. Then maybe I watch a movie. Then I'm on my phone. All of those things are different. But that's all screen time.
Exactly.
I know I sound like my own mother now, or somebody's mother, to be like, don't watch too much TV.
I mean, when you say screen, like when you say how much time do you spend looking at a screen, I'm thinking my phone alone, right? Now that you say TV, work, I'm like, yo, that's a lot of time that I spend looking at a screen,
right?
Any screen.
And just to mention one figure from the New York Times earlier this year, they found that the average American spends about 11 hours a day looking at screens.
Excuse me.
And then you're sleeping 8 hours, I'm assuming. There's not a lot of time.
What are you doing in your, like, I don't understand. What do you do in your life? 11
exactly.
Hours looking at a screen. Hopefully eight sleeping. Maybe you cut down on sleep. That's what's happening in today's world anyway.
So here's an interesting thought, though. We've been talking about TVs and phones, which is obviously things that we've chosen, screen time that we've chosen on purpose. But there's also a lot of screen time when you don't actually want it. So think about when you're in a restaurant and I want to now connect with you, or I want to sit in a coffee shop reading or on a train or wherever, or I'm walking down the street. And there are a lot of screens that sort of distract you. Have you ever been in the space where like the cricket is on and you're trying to focus on your friends, but then your eye keeps going to the screen?
See, I'm going to twist that story a little bit. It's I'm with my friends, there's cricket on, but I don't feel like being a part of this conversation. So I'm going to watch the TV. Like I'm going to force myself to love cricket that day and just focus. That's what normally happens.
Well, maybe your friends would thank you if you bought this next discovery, which is what I want to talk about. So two guys in the United States decided that all of this screen time, even the accidental or the not chosen screen time, is too much. It gets to our brains. It's always in our faces somewhere. And wouldn't it be nice if sometimes you could just switch that all off? So they found a way. They're called, Ivan Cash and Scott Blue, and they are the team behind the IRL, so like in real life, okay. the short term for that, IRL glasses. They look like sunglasses, and you can still see everything in the world just fine, right? Except one thing. Screens.
So it's blocking out the screens?
Yes. I can show you a picture in just a minute. But basically, if you imagine standing in a room where there are TV screens, it looks like you're looking through like mildly dark sunglasses and everything looks fine. But when you look at a screen, it's black.
Oh, so even if the screen is on, it's just going to be black.
Yes. And thereby not influencing your eyes and your mind. And you'll be much calmer, according to them. So, say you're on a busy street or, as I said, in a sports bar, you would see everything. And the idea is to give your eyes and so everything except those screens. So, you're giving yourself a little bit of a rest from the digital world. You can focus on your book or the conversation and not get distracted.
I mean, that sounds really cool, but how does it work?
So it's pretty simple, and I was surprised by this, partly because they have only made the very first version and they're using this Kickstarter to try to get funds to properly research and develop this product. At first, they used something called the Casper cloaking technology, which is already being used specifically as a film on like glass windows of offices and boardrooms. So say I'm inside a boardroom and I'm showing you some top secret thing, then the people outside wouldn't be able to see what's on the screens.
So is it that kind of glass that they use in identification spaces, like, in police stations?
Like one-way glass? No. You can still see through it, you just can't see the screens.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so you can still see like, oh, Leb was in that meeting, but you can't see what's on, that she's looking at cat pictures instead of the meeting notes. Right. So at first they used that kind of film, and it worked, but after a while, they figured out they can actually make this themselves really easily. If you take any polarized lens, like the ones that most of our sunglasses are made out of, flatten it and rotate it by 90 degrees, this magic screen blocking power is activated.
Okay, before we talk about the superpowers that this thing has, I hear this a lot, right? But I don't pay attention to it because it's irrelevant to my life. But how do polarized lenses work again?
It's not irrelevant. You should protect your eyes, Lebo, but I will explain it to you. So to put it simply, I'm going to make this as simple as I can. Our eyes tend to like certain angles of light hitting it and others not that much. So for instance, if light waves come in at a vertical angle, that's usually quite nice for our eyes. But if they come in at horizontal, very straight angles, that'll cause that feeling when you're looking at, like, say a bright car in the sun and like there's glare.
Oh yeah.
So polarized lenses, you can imagine them almost like stripes or like a fence. Imagine you're looking at like a wooden fence and the light only goes through half of it.
Okay.
You got that picture?
Yeah.
That's sort of on a teeny tiny level how a polarized lens looks. So it only lets through certain strips of light in a way, or certain angles.
So it lowers the intensity that the light strikes you at?
Only some angles of light.
Okay.
Making that easier for your eyes. So now, if you rotate it, it's like some angles get darker.
Ah, so when it makes sense. It's just that aha moment. Like, if you change the angle,
right,
then the angle that it reflects back at will be like, it will be dark and not as bright as it was initially.
So figuring out what is the angle of most, you know, TV screens or whatever, that's sort of what they figured out. And it turned out to be much easier than they thought it would be, just that 90 degree rotation. So after they used that Casper form I was talking about, they created their own. And the design, I'm going to show you a picture really quickly over here. The design is pretty old school, right?
I mean, it's very flat and unflattering to the face.
So they had a bunch of different designs here, but they chose this very much to make a point, not because it was the cutest design, because they modeled these glasses after a magical pair of glasses in an old 1988 movie called They Live, where if you looked through those glasses, you saw, you didn't see advertising, you only saw the truth.
Okay, yeah. That's an interesting pair of glasses. I guess while in the 80s you may have felt bombarded by actual billboards and ads, now we're most influenced by screens.
Yes.
So this really works, or what?
So, yes, apparently it does work. It's coming out in April next year, but the tech is still limited. So the current lenses work for LCD and LED screens, but not OLED screens. So basically what that means is most TVs and some computers will be blacked out, but not most smartphones or digital billboards, which, I don't know, I feel like those are things that I would want to block out, like smartphones of other people, for instance.
Yeah, smartphones, I'd buy these glasses for a couple of friends of mine. Just like, oh, here, a pair of glasses. Then they're like, fam, I can't see anything with your glasses on. That's the point.
Finally, you're focusing on me.
Exactly, I can finally talk to you. But I mean, looking at this design, in the time that we're living in, people can make this work, honestly. Yeah. Even though it's a very flat look.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it makes sense to me to just want that opportunity to have that sort of break for your eyes and your brain. But one of my main things is, why did they have to? Maybe they had to, but the fact that it's so dark, I wish it was see-through and not basically sunglasses, because surely a lot of screens are inside. So if I would like these glasses when, say, I'm sitting somewhere where there is a screen, but I want to read. But now if it's dark.
Exactly. It's just going to dim everything.
Yeah. So that's one of my concerns. But hey, if you think this is great, you are the kind of person that's always bothered by screens, why not throw some cash at them? Then they can make these even better.
Just throw it at them.
Yeah. And then you'll get some also on Kickstarter. That was some things from our, you know, just the world of science, what's happening in the news. After the break, we go into more recent interesting news, specifically around a grave of dinosaurs found in the Eastern Cape.
This is The Science Inside with Elmer.
Hello, welcome to the show. My name is indeed Elna Schutz.
And I'm Lebogang Madisha. Today on the show, we're keeping all things dinosaur, talking about the deceased of our planet before our time.
You say that with such a happy voice, but I'm low-key sad that I've never seen a real, alive dinosaur. I've seen a lot of dinosaur bones as a science journalist, but I'd like a pet brontosaurus.
See, the thing is, Elna, I'm freaked out by a lot of animals. So if I'm freaked out by the animals that are here now, imagine a dinosaur in front of me. I'd faint. I'd die. Like, they wouldn't even have to attack me. I'd just die by looking at them. I'm too scared of those things.
So today, we won't scare you too much because these aren't alive. They are fossils. But we have a story from our producer, Bridget LePere, about a recent discovery of a grave of dinosaurs in the Eastern Cape. Have a listen.
The dinosaur fossil discovery at Gqeberha, a village in the Eastern Cape, has been dubbed South Africa's very own Jurassic Park, adding to its paleontological history, bragging rights to be the first African country by far to house the oldest dinosaur bones dating as far back as 200 million years. The discovery has attracted interest from all over the world. Geologists and paleontologists working on the discovery say such well-preserved dinosaur fossils in one place is the first of its kind in the world. Wits University paleontologist from the Evolutionary Studies Institute unit, Professor Jonah Chuenere, shares his story.
A local man, Mr. Dumangwe in Kameha, was tending his flock of sheep, and he was walking them by this heavily eroded area, which is close to the entrance to town. And he found these strange rocks coming out. And he knew that there are several people in the area interested in fossils and in, you know, ancient things in the earth. And so he reported them to his neighbor, who's a guy named Skinyani Khalani. And Skinyani is a really interesting person. He's a Jehovah's Witness, preaches in Dina, like right over the hill from this village. But he's also quite a history buff. And he knows a lot about natural history as well. So he identifies animals. He knows a lot about the Boer Wars and previous, you know, comings and goings of people.
He initially spotted these fossils. So then he just brought to me little pieces of them. Then I even confirmed to him that looks like these are fossils of the dinosaurs, the big creature. Actually, you would just see by the looks of it, though they have tend to be fossilized, but there are some traces of a bone. And I walk with this guy, then I encourage him that we just go along and we scout the place. Then we discover it more. Though to an ordinary person like myself, they look like a mere stone or a rock. But you would see the knees and the vertebrae bones, and those were huge things.
Khalani says prior to actually getting to the right people, he had contacted many universities in order to share his historic findings. But upon sending the required artifacts to the Wits University, he was then contacted by Jonah and his team.
We photographed them and then we sent them to Wits with other bullets from the 1898 Anglo Boer War here in this area. And a stump of a tree, they named it an old Karoo tree stump, which is also fossilized here in the house here. From there, Mr. Joanna, the professor, confirmed that those were dinosaur fossils in there. And they promised to come here on the 16th of November last year, that they really indeed came. Then they examined these bones here in the house, and then I took them to the sites. They were so impressed. Especially when seeing these sites, they even said these sites, seemingly they are great sites of the dinosaurs. Being impressed, they promised that they would be coming back again. They are going to ask for grants and funding. It was about 6 months or 7 months or so since, but in July, they again corresponded with us through Mr. May. Mr. May has been very instrumental because he was so helpful to us. Because one of his daughters was a student in those years. Then we sent some samples to his daughter. That was before the second trip of Professor John and his students.
So how was Khalani able to distinguish these dinosaur fossils to elephant bones or some other creature which may have died there in the most recent centuries? In the following, he relates a folk tale which is popular among African people, a tale that rationalizes how beasts such as dinosaurs and men once coexisted and how they might have been wiped out.
People of long ago, especially in our native, the Amakosa people would say these were Amakongo. Those were huge creatures of long ago. The Basotos would say, that's a bird. Which means these were huge creatures which ate and wiped all the humankind, and people were starting afresh in their population. So those people were not educated, but they knew that once there were so huge creatures around which were roaming this area. So, I mean, it does not need one to have an academic knowledge to identify these.
From this expedition, what can humans learn from the ancient bones of a creature that seems so distant to man?
So Sarah Wirtz, who's a professor in archaeology, came to me and she said, these are a bit old for me to study. And I looked at them and I said, well, these are very nice dinosaur bones. And they were just a couple samples. Often we get reports from people, from local farmers or people who live in the area, and we can't follow up on all of them. But these people spend more time in the land than we do. I get to go away 2 or 3 weeks a year. And these guys are there herding sheep every day. So we had time at the end of a field trip in 2017, and we were driving past Starkspruit, which isn't that far from this village. And I said, look, to my crew, I think we should just go up there and we should take a look and see what they found. And we were introduced to the local guys, and, you know, right away it's like, oh my goodness. My hopes were a bit low, to be honest. And Mr. Khalani, together with a local teacher named Temba Jika Jika, took us out to the site. And just within minutes, like, the whole way we thought about this had been transformed. So we're looking at the base of a low mountain, big erosional surface coming off into a plain going down to the river, which ultimately feeds the Senku in that area and goes on to make the border with Lesotho. And we're in this outwash plain, and the erosion had cut deep into the bedrock, so to speak. And everywhere erosion had cut in, you'd look along the banks, and there were just dinosaur bones, like, literally falling out the sides of them. And this area is maybe a dozen hectares or something like that in size, where we were initially taken. And in almost every single erosional gully has bones, like the ones that we're sitting here with today, coming out. And then Mr. Khalani said, well, I've also identified 50 other locations in the area where I found dinosaur bones, or where people have reported it to me. And then I knew this is a community that's got above the sort of normal level of investment in this. These are people who I think are pretty reliable about reporting this stuff. I mean, we were just so impressed. I immediately called my international collaborators and local collaborators here in South Africa too. And I said, I think we've got a big story. We need to go back and evaluate this stuff. And so this trip that we just came back from September 10th to 21st, was our first, essentially our first foray into exploring the quality of this find.
According to Jonah, Qameha predates what is referred to as the Max Extinction Event. And what this means for South Africa is that Qameha has become the key that unlocks historic events that were once buried for centuries, which places South Africa on the international map.
This last field trip, which went from September 10th to 21st, 2018, and we're just back from it now, was our first expedition or foray into trying to figure out what these dinosaurs were actually doing there, how old they were, how they came to be there, and that sort of thing. And so we spent about 2 weeks excavating, looking at the rocks, collecting geological, sedimentological, and biological information. And we took some specimens back to the lab for analysis. We've left some specimens there that we'll come back and take later. And what we know now, or at least what we think we know, is that this, more than 200 million years ago, Qameha wasn't like it is today. It was a flat plain, and it had big streams cutting through it. And as those streams wandered through the landscape, occasionally animals died and fell into them. And when the streams moved those carcasses down the stream, they deposited them on the banks. And this area that we were shown by Mr. Khalani and others in 2017 is a place where the river was frequently dumping dead animals onto its banks and then covering them in mud again. Cover them in enough mud and wait enough million years and they become fossils. And what we're doing now is the erosion system, and now the biological agents of erosion, which are paleontologists, are cutting down through that ancient soil and mud and exposing the dinosaurs and other animals that had died there. We know that this is an ancient ecosystem, and what we know is that it was home to a number of large dinosaurs, stuff that weighed as much as a rhino, maybe more, 1 ton and above. But there's also other things in it too, and some of them we can't identify. And this is really important. So there's fossil discovery in South Africa. It goes back to the mid-1800s. So we've been doing this for a long time. And the early history of fossil exploration was a bit of a gentleman's hobby. And I think as a science, it's really only picked up since the mid-1940s or so, just after World War II. There was a much greater interest in paleontology and the origins of major vertebrate groups and things like that. And South Africa was certainly party to that. We played a huge role, as many people will know, in the origin of humans, understanding that origin, the origin of understanding mammals. But the dinosaur work hasn't been as extensive. But what we have here is a great fossil record that spans an extinction event, one of Earth's mass extinctions. It's very important for understanding how the modern biota, the modern fauna of animals, came into being. And that extinction event happens about 200 million years ago. And that's really, really important. This is called the End Triassic Extinction Event. And we talk about Big Five in South Africa a lot. It's one of the Big Five extinction events. And the rocks on Earth that record that extinction event are very hard to find. In fact, they're very sparsely distributed. And so when we are trying to look at how did life on Earth change from before that extinction to after, there's very few places we can look to actually uncover fossils and try to interpret that change. South Africa is one of those places. So what we know is that about 50% of life dies off 200 million years ago, very rapidly. We think it's related to volcanic eruptions that are stemming from the Atlantic Ocean opening between South America and what is today Africa. And those sets of eruptions changed the Earth's atmosphere and the ocean's chemistry, and that caused a lot of groups to go extinct. Well, importantly, what happens at this extinction is that before the extinction event in the Triassic, the dominant large land-dwelling vertebrates are actually related to crocs and today's mammals.
So dinosaurs gave rise to their most recent relatives, crocodilians, of which about 36 species can be named now. The evolution of dinosaurs is also said to have produced a variety of close to 10,000 bird species, can you believe, which would not have been possible without dinosaurs. According to Jonah, this rewriting of history is a reflection of the transformation of the biodiversity of ecosystems over the years. That story was by our producer, Bridget LePere, and it's pretty amazing, Nebo.
It is. The recent findings that have been going on, especially, and this one in particular, because it's not very often that you find fossils just all together.
Right, right.
You find bits and pieces of a particular fossil. Maybe you'll find an arm or a leg, maybe even a toe, but it's not like you find a whole grave site, an array of fossils.
Exactly. We will get into more around dinosaurs, paleontology, all of that later in the show. But after the break, we take a little bit of just a shot left with our unscience.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Now is the time of the show called Unscience. We get a little bit weird and wonderful, look at some research that is unusual or just there to teach you something new, Lebo. Today's Unscience was produced by Harmony Molefi from the University of Oxford, and music is by Ben Sound and soundbible.com. Let's get into it.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
Now, bald male birds fall faster and harder for their partners.
Okay.
This is what scientists get up to in their free time, guys. They find out if bald male birds like birds even more. I don't know. It's just weird stuff that we're up to out here. Now, do you ever think if animals put as much effort into getting their mates as people do?
I think in a sense, because it's a pretty important part of being an animal, you know, one of those basic instincts, like,
true,
be safe, have food, mate.
But I didn't think they put in like a lot of effort. You know, with people, you think, oh no, they must look like this, I don't want them to be like that or whatever. You have very specific characteristics you look for.
Okay, that's true. I do think that animals are not as like specific.
They're not as specific, but they actually put in effort.
Okay.
They really do. And a new study has found that bald male birds focus on forming strong relationships with their future breeding partners, while the shy male birds seem to not really put as much effort and would rather settle for less.
Oh, so the shy male birds are like scaredy cats, basically.
I mean, they could be. I guess you could say they're scaredy cats. Or they just don't put as much effort, I don't know.
Or they're lazy.
They're lazy. They're just lazy birds. That's what's happening. A new study from Oxford University's zoology department has revealed that individual personalities of male birds influence how they can form bonds with their future breeding partners.
So basically you're saying that the female birds would want to have a sense of the personality of the male bird beforehand?
Pretty much. It's been proven that the bolder productive males can get partners sooner, and they seem to put more effort into their relationship before breeding season starts. However, shy males are less devoted to finding partners sooner and forming strong bond pairs. And instead, they spend more time like flocking with the other females.
Okay, with this strange kind of research, I always have to ask, how exactly did they prove this?
So the study has demonstrated that differences in behavior can shape the formation of social relationships in the wild. According to Dr. Josh Frith, finding a mate is of importance to birds just as many of the other species in the animal kingdom.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that's understandable. And so with this research, they wanted to ask why individuals of some species differ so much in how much effort they put into forming these relationships. In this research, personalities of hundreds of individual birds were assessed by looking at how they live and interact with others. Radio frequency identification tags were used to track the bird's social networks over a period of time. These tags would particularly report the bird's quacks or sounds as a form of them interacting with others.
Okay, tell me more.
So Dr. Frith has added that they have shown how personality plays an important role in explaining the differences in pair bonding tactics.
Okay, we're making fun of the birds, but it does actually sound very similar to humans.
It really does, because we put in effort and we analyze like personality before we get with someone or like... Yeah, that didn't come out as planned.
So what exactly were the findings when it came to the birds?
So they'd found that productive males dedicate more time to choosing their future partners, even long before mating season starts. And the scaredy cats or the lazy birds are less productive, and they take alternative options of interacting with different females as only their sisters, right up until breeding season starts, and then they're focused to choose any female they can easily find so they can mate and expand their germinal.
Okay, so basically you're saying the scaredy cat birds are interacting with females, but not in a way that they would be choosing a partner, and then last minute they're like, oh no, I need a date to the ball, and just pick whoever's around and whose feathers like match up. So are the scientists saying all, like, it would be better if all birds are like bald now and proactive?
I mean, not entirely. Through linking differences in male birds' behavior to different mating strategies, the findings suggest that there may be no best personality to have, and this has helped to further explain why there are differences in personalities. Although it could be the case that being bold and proactive is better for finding a good partner in some social interactions, while being more reserved can be preferable in other interactions.
Okay, so the shy birds shouldn't now go and try to learn more from the bold birds or like copy them?
No, not actually. Since in other studies the birds were taught how to sing new tunes and basically attract other mates, this might work in favor by the serenading of females with surprise tunes than that they are normally used to.
Okay, so that could kind of like change their behavior if they tried, but it's not really necessary, is what the scientists are saying.
Yeah, pretty much.
So it all sounds like fun, but maybe it's possible to sort of portray both characteristics a little bit?
I mean, sure. Get a bald bird that has the perfect balance of the charm, like being bold and proactive, and also be laid back, I guess.
Okay.
I suppose.
Maybe that's the ideal. That is so strange, Lebo. I've got to say, this piece of unscience is a bit... it makes me a little bit uncomfortable when research puts like human characteristics on birds. I don't know. I don't know if it's the same thing exactly.
Yeah, because they're a different species. They're a different living species. We're human, we interact differently. They're birds, they interact differently. I mean, there could be similarities, but I wouldn't link them directly to us.
Yeah, and still, I mean, hey, maybe you learn something for your love life. If you're shy, maybe these birds inspired you. It's been Unusual, Unlikely, Unscience. Catch us after the break.
Unusual, Unlikely, Unscience. This is The Science Inside with Elna.
Hello and welcome to the show.
Earlier on the show, we spoke about the new discovery of a dinosaur.
Our country has such a rich history of dinosaurs and fossils, and scientists every day are doing the slow, careful work of uncovering and understanding them. But if you think about it, these creatures have been around for so long. They don't just belong to science, Lebo. So in a sense, they belong to us as South Africans.
That is true, Elna, and that's where the idea of geomythology comes through, where stories and science collide. Stories like that of Hodumodumo and these scary monsters that are portrayed over time. As kids, we told these scary stories, and now science comes together with these stories. This is Lebogang Mofakane from Soweto telling the story.
There's morals, monitoring the you. But as children, we don't take them to heed because for Ebana, by then they just tell you the normal medicine that only to find out or like at the same time the parents are letting us know who are like the world is not as beautiful as we think. And they are the they might not be big, but Eba to Baratilanibo. So it was said for Nehonale Khodimodimo living in the village. So Khodimodimo una zabat. So what Khodimodimo used to do was that una pecha lejo, ali pecha in the fire so lejo leo, le chese, and then una le kuma so that he can change his voice into anyone's voice. So there was Selani in the village. Selani had a mother una le busy aloha woods. The mom would go to the woods as a maya alonga so that he can make fire. The mom went away, but the mom ule ajeta Selani for Selani. You must always lock yourself in the house. Selani once upon a time decided to stay outside. So whenever the mom would call Selani, Khodumodumo would always adule mole analyze the voice of mom. So mom would abita Selani amubita Selani wanaka Selani wanaka. So don't give a hobby old. Selani would respond and say, Kiautwa emme, Kiautwa emme, and then Selani would go to the house. So the mother went at Samaya Ailoha di Dimkun, or Atohona or Aesemolo for Sapa. And then Kanti, Khodumodumo Uboni Mehane Asa, Khodumodumo saw Selani outside, and Khodumodumo went in the house. So it was now lunchtime for Selani Atohona Huja, but the mother was not back yet. So now, Khodumodumo sapile lejolele, and then abe akuma lejo. And then when he shouted, Selani, wanaka, that was Khodumodumo's voice. And then Selani took time to come. And then she responded, kiautwa, emme, only to find out where Khodumodumo. It's now Selia Paula. So the stone is supposed to stay hot for him who is a voice and mewa Selani. So when the mom was on her way back home, Khodumodumo started abisa Selani hap, and then he went, Selani, emme, Selani, emme. So now the voice is changing to the mom's voice into Khodumodumo's voice at the same time. Because now Lejo Selepo dile lani kumile. And then that's how the mom saw where the monster was inside. And then she started shouting, Khodumodumo! Khodumodumo! And then the villagers came and rescued Selani. And then they killed the Khodumodumo. That was the end of the story. Khodumodumo means a very big, it's human-like giant. The giant is a Funko Jack and the Beanstalk. Those are the same giants, but they used to eat people instead of eating other things. They eat cannibals. So they used to eat people in the village, but they do like the cave. There's a difference between the other giants and the Khodumodumo was that they used to analyze people. Because most of the people, basically, not adults.
Now, Lebo, it might be easy to wonder, Alna, what does this have to do with science? But that's exactly where geomythology is important. That's when you look at the stories that are told and how they relate to scientific findings like dinosaur fossils. It can also relate to early findings and understandings of items like bones or fossils and how they were understood by the local people at the time. Dr. Charles Helm from the African Center for Coastal Paleoscience was recently speaking at an event at WITS around this and his particular work on the subject and how we as a country fit in.
So what is geomythology? To investigate and document how free scientific cultures interpreted geological and fossil data. Geomythology is very well established in North America, Europe, and all of Asia, not in Africa. Adrian Mayer, 2004, summarized geomythology across the world, nothing about Southern Africa. In 2011, she noted that further studies from Africa are, quote, eagerly awaited. So why is there this shortage from Africa and more specifically from Southern Africa? There are three possibilities. Number one, people here just didn't care. There was no indigenous geomythology. It's possible. Okay. Number two, it existed, but it left minimal traces. So it was there, but there's nothing we can find to decipher it. Number three, there's been insufficient interest in Southern Africa in exploring this discipline. Those are the three options, right?
Now, he gave us three options, so which one is it?
I will tell you that in just a minute, but what Dr. Helms is saying is that there are so many examples of where this is actually very clear. In South Africa. So I want to tell you some of those examples first and then we'll get into what his choice is. Have a listen.
So we have other examples. Busman Kopje is within Mokala National Park, and this is an engraving where you've got a tridactyl big engraving. This is now speculation, but that's what it looks like. So could this be a depiction, an engraving of a huge three-footed creature that someone had seen somewhere else and reproduced here? We've got the example of Skarplaats near Clarence. It's a beautiful, richly decorated shelter, very famous. But on the back wall, you've got three clusters of rock art, quite a few meters apart. And each of these clusters, there's a dinosaur footprint in front of it, on the ceiling or on the floor. So could it be coincidence? Yes. But could it be significant? Could be.
Okay, so that means there's a good chance that people were aware of and had specific understandings of the dinosaurs and creatures that had lived in the areas that they're in long before scientists from elsewhere came along.
Yes, and it's really interesting. Some of the examples he had, specifically from Lesotho, actually had mentions of how the people still spoke about these fossils and sort of linked it to stories of the Hurumudumu that we heard earlier. So there's so much interaction between what scientists or modern scientists or scientists from official, you know, universities are finding out and how the stories and the myths of those areas have long actually reflected those things. So As you might have guessed, it's definitely not a case of there's nothing, right? Mm. So let's get back to those three choices that he had at the beginning.
In wrapping up, if we go back to our three options, was the minimal Southern African, non-Western, indigenous geomythology? No, I think I've shown you that we have enough. It existed but left no traces? No, I've just shown you. We've got lots of traces if we keep our eyes open. So obviously, number three, it's simply that we haven't been looking in exploring this discipline. So the answer is A, yes, and B, we're working on it. I'm convinced that as more people become aware of this, they're going to give us more sites and we're going to learn a lot more. Maybe with the mythology, we can work on that. How to conclude? Non-Western cultures have natural knowledge of paleontology and geology. They incorporated this into their legends, their art, and their understanding of the world. This was one of our conclusions as a group, which was simply that in countries that are reforging their cultural identity after a colonial past, yesterday's curious collectors may become an inspiration for a new generation of Southern African paleoscientists.
So interesting how the science and the mythology come together. Geomythology just shows you that not only do dinosaurs have a long story in our country, on our continent, but the people of South Africa are aware and have interacted with these stories for a long time. You're still on The Science Inside.
Stay curious. Stay informed. Stay on The Science Inside.
It's been a great show, Lebo. I really enjoyed it.
I did too, finding out how rich our country is in dinosaur history.
A big thank you goes to all of our guests on the show today, Dr. Charles Helm, Lebogang Mofokane, Jonah Chouanier, and James Khalani.
And of course, to our team today behind the scenes in production is Bridget Lepere, Glory Mabuza, Harmony Molefe, and Kutlwano Serame.
The podcast, if you missed it, it's wits.journalism.co.za/science, and it's also on iTunes.
And you can always catch us on our social media on Facebook and Twitter as @VowFM.
My name is Elna Schutz.
And I'm Lebogang Madisha.
You have been listening to The Science Inside. We are produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. We will be with you again next week.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on VowFM 88.1. The Science Inside Podcast.